Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
How are you, sir?
This is Pierre.
Oh.
I can't believe I'm talking to you, Dr. Ray the Great.
Well, I don't know about that.
I love listening to you. You have a personality just like my father.
I don't think you should feel helpless. You are helpless.
Doctor, I really appreciate that. That makes me feel a lot better.
You be at peace, or else I'm going to yell at you.
Trying to find a reason to speak to you. I think you're the best thing since sliced bread.
That Ray, he's something.
Thank you so much for what you're doing for all the parents out there.
I don't know what I can possibly do.
I don't either.
I'm getting my money worth, I think, at this phone call.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
It all depends on the context. Somebody says, I'm getting my money's worth. Sounds like it's something of value, doesn't it? She said, I'm getting my money's worth on this phone call. She didn't pay for it. She didn't pay for the advice. She didn't pay for anything. It was zero. She got zero value. At least that's the way I took it. You think I'm insecure? I don't think I'm insecure. Do you think I'm insecure? This is Dr. Ray. Thanks for joining me here. The Doctor Is In. This is our Friday edition, Look Back Friday, where we take previous calls, edited at the very capable, adept hands of producer man Andrew Krucek over there in Ann Arbor. And he does edit them. I'll tell you that. I've noticed that. I've said, Andrew, didn't I say more about that? He goes, yeah, but I took you out. All right. Anyway, we bring the call in. Certain calls lend themselves to extrapolation. More talk, more tangents to go off on, which doesn't always happen the first time around, but the second time around, there's things I want to say about the call. It's not therapy, obviously. If this were in therapy, you could go on for 2, 3, 4, 5 sessions. But it just sprinkles in a few more ideas, a few more observations, something, hopefully, of value so that you do get your money's worth. We'll get to those momentarily. The very first book I wrote, way back, let me put you this way. I wrote this book when I had to chisel it out on stone tablets. It's called You're a Better Parent Than You Think. It was prompted by my days at the mental health center in Columbiana County, Ohio. I became the family person, the guy that dealt with a proportion of my clients were family-related issues, and there were many other issues, too, across the psychological spectrum. But about 50% of what I saw were parents. And I noticed, even at the ripe old age of, what was I when I started working on this book, 27, 28, something like that? Barely out of writing with crayon. I noticed a lot of insecurities, a lot of guilt-ridden, a lot of tentativeness, a lot of struggling with authority, and I was shocked. They kept coming in waves. Now this was back a while back, and it's not any better now. It's probably a lot worse. Hence the title: You're a Better Parent Than You Think. Obviously, how do you make a title like that? Well, because that's the people who buy parenting books. You don't get somebody who hates being a parent, who doesn't want to improve being a parent, is going to go out and buy a parenting book. That's not going to happen. Generally, it's people who are struggling to do better. And I find that in many respects, they are better parents than they think because they have better instincts and they need to allow themselves to have confidence and authority. That said, there was a chapter in the book called How to Talk Yourself Out of Authority. The springboard for that chapter was when somebody comes into the office and they're struggling with asserting their authority as a parent, usually there's a lot of reasons why they don't. You have to get to those reasons because those reasons are blocking them from doing what is good for themselves and their child. All kinds of reasons. And that's one of the aims initially of helping someone be a better parent. It isn't just a matter of, well, let me give you 6 techniques, you go do them, because if they've got emotional or misguided notions blocking them, my kid won't like me, I'll do something psychologically incorrect, I'm going to mess my kid up, my mother says I'm too strict, my standards are too high, etc., whatever it is. One of the big ones that came up was, and I call this in a subsection of the chapter, He's a special child. Meaning, the child, for whatever the reason, in the parents' eyes, is struggling. Whether it's a permanent condition, for example, a developmental delay, or, well, see, now that doesn't make sense, does it? They call it a developmental delay because a delay implies you can make it up, but not always, not always. Developmental struggles. Or a physical handicap. Or functioning through a divorce. Anything that in the parents' eyes would make the child, well, I guess you could say, ripped off by life, not getting his fair share of what a normal existence should be. I consulted to several Head Start programs early in my career, valuations, working with the teachers on some of the kids. I got called to a Head Start center because of a little boy, he was four, who was enormously disruptive, difficult to control, high level of behavior problems. This little boy also had significant hearing loss, even with hearing aids. As it turned out, interviewing the teacher, and I believe I did get a chance to talk to the parents too, it was way, way back, the parents felt bad. This little guy had been ripped off. He did not have normal hearing. As a result, they didn't discipline him. They felt he was already frustrated enough with his particular developmental issue, and they didn't want to limit him in many ways. Consequently, in the class, most, if not all, of the other kids avoided him. They didn't like him. They didn't want to include him. They didn't want to play with him. They didn't really want him all that much near them. And it turned out that his main handicap was becoming social, behavioral. It was impeding his progress even more than his hearing impairment. The parents were very reluctant to normally discipline this young man because they felt, he's already dealing with enough. I shouldn't have to stand him in a corner, too. I see this a lot. And it isn't just physical handicaps. I see it very much, for example, when a family splits up. The custodial parent may feel very, very badly about the fact that these children or this child no longer has a full-time father or mother on the scene. Therefore, as they are wrestling or struggling with disciplining them, raising them, they feel bad. Single parent guilt, I called it in one of the chapters. We adopted our twins when they were four. They had a very, very turbulent first year and a half of life. They were placed in a foster home for about 2.5 years. For whatever the reasons, the foster parents were reluctant to discipline. They had their own special reasons why they didn't want to discipline, which I don't want to get into those details right now. Both foster parents have since passed away. The children were very, very difficult, particularly the young men. The little girl was more of a withdrawn, insecure, emotionally delicate. The little boy was temper-prone, in-your-face, defiant. At one point, in a momentary forgetfulness of you're a better parent than you think, I said to my wife, honey, maybe we could just relax our standards with the kids a little bit because they're getting more than their share of discipline. And that's true. That's the way it was. At that point, we had 6, 5, 4, 4, 3, and 1. And the twins were 4. And they were definitely gobbling up more of our discipline time. My wife, being naturally more insightful than I am, said, Ray, we can't do that. Our standards are the same for everybody. What we'll do is we will give the twins more affection, more love, more just more of the good stuff of parenthood, more of it to compensate for the times that they spent sitting on the steps, gone to the corner, gone to bed early, whatever. For a moment there, I had struggled with, well, if you want to call it adoptive parent guilt, I had wondered, okay, these kids have already just had a rough first 4 years. And here I am onto the scene, having standards that I want to raise my children by, but clearly this is a shock to these two little guys' systems. By the way, I'm using the word guy in the generic sense. But my wife was right. The lesson to be taken from this is that we do a child no favors by having lax standards, poor discipline, permissive style, because we think that they are special circumstances. We can hug more. We can kiss more. We can pay more attention. We can spend more time. We can do a lot more of those things that show this child they are loved. But it doesn't help anybody to function according to the life has already ripped this child off, and therefore if I ask him to dry the dishes or I make him go to bed early because of his conduct, I'm just adding to the ripoff. Not a good way to parent, and it doesn't help the child. I'm Dr. Ray.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Why is the calling on the name of Jesus so powerful? According to the Catholic Catechism, to pray Jesus is to invoke him and to call him within us. We are welcoming the Son of God who loved us and gave himself up for us. A simple invocation developed through tradition in both East and West and transmitted by the spiritual writers of the Sinai, Syria, and Mount Athos is, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on us sinners. Through this prayer, the human heart is open to human wretchedness and the Savior's mercy. Invoking the holy name of Jesus is the simplest way of praying always. If the heart is humbly attentive, the prayer is not lost by heaping up empty phrases. It holds fast to the word and brings forth fruit with patience. The prayer of the church also honors the heart of Jesus and the way of the cross, which we call making the stations. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Why do we need Catholic radio? Because not everybody's sitting in front of a computer or watching their television set at home. How about when driving to work? Catholic radio's there for you. I may be a Catholic priest, but I'm still a student of the faith. And Catholic radio helps supply good material, whether it be a question and answer format show, whether it be a show itself on doctrine or theology. I myself, as a priest, am always learning.
Father Wade thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
Dr. Ray Guarendi, only host in all of Catholic radio that can take days off your purgatory, because I can be so irritating to listen to. And if you force yourself to listen against your will, I think that could just pay off in the end. All right, this is Look Back Friday. Let's go straight to it. Sandra called from Illinois.
I'm like at a hitting the wall here with my son. He's going on 36 years old. He's been doing drugs since about 19 years old.
Oh.
Coke and smoke.
Oh.
And
Oh.
Yeah. And he just got out of a rehab 2 years ago in Des Moines, Iowa. And so he stayed in Des Moines after the rehab was 28 days in rehab for $25,000 that I paid. And he's back to doing drugs and over drinking, can't keep a job. He's got his own apartment since October 31st until he can't figure out how to make any more money because he keeps losing jobs because he can't get to work on time. He's got absenteeism problems, he's still doing drugs and over drinking, and I know he's going to come to me for money, and I really don't want to give it to him. I'm in Iowa as well. I got an apartment there when he got out of rehab. 6 months after he got out of rehab, he was with his uncle for 6 months, and then I took over and moved up there and got an apartment for the both of us, a one-bedroom, and because I fly a lot, I'm a flight attendant. So he moved out, got his own place. He's trying, but he keeps falling, and he's still falling, and I'm afraid he's going to get deeper into this to where he will lose his apartment, he'll lose his car, he'll be in jail or another overdose, because he overdosed about 3 years ago in Chicago. He overdosed, and they told him to get it into a rehab, but at the time, we couldn't afford it, but I got the money 2 years ago.
Well, it sounds to me, Sandra, like you've gone over and above the call of duty.
I know, but I have, but he's my son.
Well, here's the question you have to ask yourself.
What is it?
Well, is it helping him or hurting him by giving him money or by paying for his... Yes.
Well, yeah, it's going to come to that because he's going to be out of a job and lose his job. He just lost his job in January 17th to the 20th.
Sandra,
I don't know
are you saying that you couldn't live with yourself if your son, who is already on the streets, or even worse, that somehow, some way you would say, or worse, because he's already overdosed once. Yes.
Yeah.
So you're saying you couldn't live with yourself because you'd always be wondering, did I do everything I should have done?
I could live with myself because I know I'm doing everything that I can so far.
Okay.
Up to this day, yes.
But after 17 years of this lifestyle and after you on and off helping him as you could.
And his dad has helped him as well.
Okay. So when will you say... That's it, son. You're on your own.
I don't know. I don't know when I'm going to say that. I don't know if I should let him be a bum and go in the streets and panhandle for money and or end up in jail or end up dead or provide shelter for him until, I give him another chance, until he tries to
Sandra, you can do anything you want. You can do anything you want, dear. However,
what do you suggest, though?
Well, as a psychologist, I'm not going to tell you what to do with your son because I don't know all the details. But I will tell you, as a psychologist, who probably this is now the number one problem I deal with, of parents whose adult children are making an absolute mess of their lives. At some point, the adult parent, the big person, the older person... has to decide. That is it. I have a couple of children myself that I will not give another dime to at all. Because they have not acted responsibly when I did try to help them. I love them. We're still connected. But that's not going to happen. I believe that if I were to give them monetary help, or if I were to somehow let them come back and live at home, I would not be helping them. I would be hurting them. That's why I don't do it. It's not a matter of, okay, buddy, you've just blown it. No. It's a matter of, I don't want to be involved in hurting you. Because if I continue to do this, all I'm doing is hurting you. Now, if somebody says, yeah, but Dr. Ray, what if they crash and burn? Which is your fear, Sandra, which is the fear of virtually every parent I talk to. At some point, you have to say, I can no longer sustain this. This is not good. The longer it goes, the worse it gets. I wish that my profession or the mental health folks at large would talk more about this. It is a major byproduct of a culture that is abandoning moral conduct, and that is the number of older parents watching their young adult children make a shambles of their lives. As I said in the call, it's probably one of, well, if it's not my number one referral, it's in the top three. Very, very common. The dynamic is the one that Sandra was talking about. I'm blackmailed. I don't know. I can't predict how it will go. And if I would not pay his rent, which is, I think, what she was implying, he's out. He's on the streets. Now, one aspect of this is that there are programs, there are places that a person can go to. For example, during the day, where I live, there is a place where they can go during the day. They get meals and they get taken care of and they get hooked up with social workers. This can be. There are programs like this. Oftentimes, people don't take advantage of them, but they're there. That's one thing. Another thing is the ultimate fear. The ultimate fear of, if I don't continue in some way to support this 42-year-old, 36-year-old, 27-year-old, if I don't, I wouldn't rule out a very serious or fatal outcome. Now, here is the balancing act. Is it more or less likely that the fatal outcome will occur if you continue upon this same trajectory? In other words, you act irresponsibly, you make terrible decisions, you mess up job opportunities, you don't pay bills, you continue to use chemicals. Is it likely, more or less, that you will end up doing something very serious to yourself, even though I've continued to try to help you, bail you out financially, let you live at home, pay your bills, buy you another car, whatever it is I do? Because if there is a protracted level of irresponsibility, self-destructive kind of behavior, the longer it goes on, one could make the case that it makes it even more likely something bad will happen. Real bad. Now, of course, if the parent says, that's it, you're on your own, I love you, come over here, I'll cook you a meal, but other than that, no money, no bailouts, then that child, adult child, still a child, I guess, is going to bounce along the bottom. Will they come back up after hitting bottom or not? You can't know. You can't know. It is a risk. The question is it a higher risk if you continue to quasi-support, quasi-enable, quasi-finance? That's the question. My son Peter made an interesting observation. He said, you know, Dad, more in your generation, when you hit rock bottom, you bounced up. He says, many in my generation, they hit rock bottom and they party down there with their friends.
The Wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Now, when Jesus was on earth, he taught us a great lesson. He taught us that he came for the sinner, not the virtuous. He came for you because you are imperfect, because sin comes easy to you, and sometimes you don't have the willpower to say no. But you see, if you understood the awesomeness of God and all his power and all his wonder, and he comes down to our level. He wanted to feel. How do you feel? I don't know anybody that loves anyone that much. And this imperfect being that's you and me and all of us, he did it for us. That's why you should never despair, because you're imperfect.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams. Contemplate the universe with me.
Where does darkness dwell? Have you seen the gates of the deepest darkness?
What we can see of the cosmos is only one-tenth of the mass needed to explain stable spinning galaxies. Science's answer? Massive amounts of dark matter, or stuff we can't see. But the gravitational force of all that dark matter would cause the universe to shrink and collapse. Except the universe is not collapsing, it's expanding. How is that possible? Science's answer? Dark energy. And just like that, the Earth was saved. And just exactly what is dark matter and dark energy, and where does it come from? We have no idea. But God knows, and one day you will too. At AveMariaRadio.net, under Resources, explore the universe with me. I'm Dr. Stan Williams.
Some of you older folks might remember when we were younger, you went into a fractious phone call. It was unpleasant. And the person hung up on you, or the end of the conversation, and you slammed the receiver down. Remember that? It was hanging on the wall. You got, poof, slammed it down, or sitting on a cradle. You, boom. You can't do that with cell phones. You'll break your screen. You know, how hard can you really push the off button? You know, it just doesn't have the same cathartic effect, does it? Dr. Ray, glad you're with me here on The Doctor Is In. Yeah, right, Andrew. He says just throw it. Yeah, well, they charge you $800 for these things. My heavens. My mother, I asked my mom, Mom, what's your phone bill? This was way back. This is back when we had one phone in the kitchen with an 8-foot cord. $6 a month. Now, I know most people with cell phones are paying $50 to $150 a month, especially if they have a family plan, maybe more. Isn't that something? Our standard of living has gone up, and we expect normal living at a higher level. All right, I better get to this. Charlie, we had some fun with this call, and I'm not exactly sure why I picked it, but he's from Washington. He says, strict parents are an island.
Well, thank God for my father. He gave me the blueprint on how to raise two young boys. And I'm telling you, being the strict parent these days, you're kind of out on an island. I've noticed things when you're coaching baseball or you're doing things with other groups of kids and parents, the looks you get from the children, they'll look at you like, what did you ask me to do? You want me to do what? And then of course I insist it, and I keep with them and make them, practice or do their drills or what have you. And you know what's funny, Dr. Ray, is after a while, couple of practices, pretty soon the kids are giving you as a coach back than they give their parents. So I just wanted to call in and say thank you so much for what you're doing for all the parents out there. You're right on the money. We're raising two young boys out here in the Northwest and riding dirt bikes all the time. What a blast. So I wanted to pour a little sugar on you after that eclair.
Charlie, I appreciate it, but I'm going to add a qualifier. I would appreciate it more if you said to me When I first started listening to you, I didn't agree with much of what you said. However, I found your logic and your reason compelling. And I want you to know that I have changed a lot of my thinking on morality, on child rearing, on basically life in general. Now, that would be cool. However, not to trivialize your wonderfully sugary words, where you said, Dr. A, I like what you say. Now, part of it, Charlie, now, again, forgive me, I think you like what you say because you agree with me. So if you didn't agree with me, you'd say, "What? Who the heck's this dude? He doesn't know what he's talking about," as some of my emails say. So, no, I'm teasing you, Charlie. I do appreciate the kind words. And how old are your boys?
7 and 4.
You can't know if my ways are messing them up yet.
Well, holding them responsible, personal responsibility, you know, like you were talking about with lies. When I catch them in their little white lies, they're just learning about the tools of lies right now in their lives, you know.
They realize you're not omniscient.
They know that dad knows all and sees all. And
at least a 4-year-old thinks that, Charlie. The 7-year-old's starting to think, hey, wait a minute.
Well, dad's the one who keeps the dirt bike running, you see. So there is magical powers.
You're a god from Olympia. You're a god from Olympia. You know what? I was a little worried about you there for a second. I was worried for a second because you said you listened to the show, and I knew your IQ was going up. And I'm thinking, unless your wife listens, you're going to outstrip her in IQ. And that causes problems in a relationship. But as long as she's listening, you're both gone up at equal amounts.
She has listened a few times, absolutely. And, you know, in this world, the only thing we can do is lead by example. And you're a great example, Dr. Ray, and I sure appreciate you.
I was wondering if Andrew would edit that part out or not, you know, but he didn't, and it only cost me $8 for him to leave it in. One of the books I wrote, I talked about something that parents with high standards, traditional morals, religious beliefs that they take into their whole family and living have to deal with. Less of the culture sees things their way. I ran across some very, very disturbing statistics. I knew it in a vague sense, but seeing the numbers shook me up. And I don't know how they asked the question, but they were comparing 1996 to 2018. And the jump, for example, in 2018, approximately 80% of people thought that living together is just morally fine. Children out of wedlock. It was high. It was 60-70%. This was not people who did it. This was people who thought it was morally no problem whatsoever, which indicates a couple of things. One, there's less religious people. We know that, especially among the young. But two, we've redefined religion. Those aspects really are not a part of religion anymore. So one of the things I deal with a lot in therapy is something that Charlie said, which is strict parents are an island. That is true. And unless you have someone in your social circle, in your family, some little bit of support of someone who thinks along the lines you do, you're going to wobble because you will get assaulted from every direction by the media, the culture at large. Unfortunately, family and friends and others who will look at you waiting for your parenting with its high standards, lovingly high standards, to blow up in your face. That's what they're looking for. I've seen it over and over and over and over again. People who have tried to adhere to anti-cultural high moral standards, if their kids drift, which happens a lot, it does, but that doesn't have anything to do with the high moral standards, but they're accused of that. You see what happens? You see what happens when you raise kids that way? You knew it. It's going to happen. That's what they do. They rebel against it. They're not going to go to church anymore. Are you kidding me? But here's the irony to that statistic. The percentage of kids raised in solid God-loving, moral homes who turn out to be responsible, loving, God-seeking adults is still higher than those children raised with minimal religion, with the culture having huge influence, or no religion. If you want to look at the stats at all kinds of levels, social, emotional, spiritual, it's still better to have those high standards, however anti-cultural they are. Now, Catechism Wisdom with me, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and Father Larry Richards.
Father Larry, church talks a lot about charity, right? Let me read to you something that the Catechism says, section 2447. The works of mercy are charitable actions by which we come to the aid of our neighbor in his spiritual and bodily necessities. Instructing, advising, consoling, comforting are spiritual works of mercy. My profession says that we need to have people meet our needs. Now, this here seems to be a little, I don't want to say antagonistic, but maybe contrary to that.
The way of the world says me, me, me. The way of God says you, you, you. And when we sit there and we focus on the reality, it's in giving away your life, Jesus says, that you find life. That is so anti-world, isn't it?
I serve to feel better.
Exactly. That's where we get everything. It's in giving away your life that you find life. That's the cross. That's the way of Christianity.
That's contrary to conventional wisdom.
Yeah, and that's the point.
Okay. Well, enough said there. Sorry. You know, catechism puts things on its head according to conventional wisdom.
Absolutely. Jesus comes and changes the world and turns the world upside down and says, you want life, then you give away life. And it's in that we find true life. It's in serving that we become more fully who we are. As God left heaven, if you will, became a man and gave his life for us. And when we do the same, just as he found eternal life in his humanity, so will we. A life of self is a wasted life. God says, I'll take care of number one. You take care of others. And when you give away and you live a life of service, that's when you're going to find life.
So others are number one.
You got it. I have a thing that says, Jesus first, others second, yourself last. The life of joy, huh? That's the exact opposite of what the world says. But when you do that, you will have a joyful life.
Dr. Ray Guarendi, program doctor, is in Monday through Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time. This is our Friday version. Look back Friday, take previous calls. Edited, and comment more on them. There's always more to say about a call, but because of the exigencies of time and callers, in the beginning of the call, we try to focus on the main matter that the person is calling about, but there are often ancillary matters that could be addressed on a look-back show, which is what we try to do. Edgar Morrow said something. You remember Edgar Morrow, or at least you've heard about him. He's a journalist. Very, very high-profile journalist, did a lot of reporting on World War II. He said something that makes me nervous, truly does. He said, just because your voice reaches halfway around the world doesn't mean you are wiser than when it reached only to the end of the bar. Ain't that the truth? I talked about, one of the books I wrote was called Advice Worth Ignoring, and I talked about how numbers make people an expert. In other words, if they have a social media platform and they have 186,000 followers and they're dispensing advice, well, obviously they must be smart. Look at how many followers they got. A lot of stickers on their system. Or a particular TV show that has a large following, 2, 3, 4, 6 million. That was nothing in the old days when you only had three or four shows at a time to choose from. But now when you have 682,000 shows to choose from, you grab 2, 3, 4, 5 million. That's incredibly high. But the implication is, well, you obviously must be really smart. You must be worth listening to, because look at all the numbers that follow you. So numbers aren't necessarily an indicator. Numbers could be that you're appealing to the lowest common denominator among people. Just because your voice reaches halfway around the world doesn't mean you are wiser than when it reached only to the end of the bar. Teresa from California. Her husband wants a divorce.
Okay, so I took your advice because I listened to you all the time, and you said, okay, go to counseling. We went to counseling because 2.5 years ago he said, I love you, but I'm not in love with you. So that was like a big red flag. So we went to counseling, and I knew it in my heart he was seeing somebody. But in counseling, he would deny it, let it go. Well, God is so good to me. And Mother Mary, I prayed all the time. And I saw some pictures. And what are the chances of me seeing some pictures with this woman? Then he confessed and let it go. Then he wanted to work on the marriage. And I think he just checked out. So what do I do?
How long have you been married, Nancy?
25 years. It'll be 25 years in June.
Are there still kids at home?
Yes, I have. Okay, I was married before previously, and then I have a daughter with him that's 16. And that's, I'm willing to sacrifice my life so my daughter could still be in a, you know, parent home with not divorce, you know, mother and father together. Because I know how divorce is. And I promised to God I would never get divorced again. I promised God.
Or you and didn't.
I'm willing to do anything, but I'm...
Tracy, you didn't get divorced again.
No, we're still married.
You're having it forced upon you.
Yes.
So that isn't your decision. You're not saying, okay, I don't like this guy and I want out of here. You're not doing that. He is saying.
No, I'm doing that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, you suspect he is still seeing this woman?
Well, he says he's not, but, I don't know why people are dumb. The person that's getting cheated on knows it in their heart. But
they pick up distance. Women are incredibly good at picking up subtle social cues that something is very different. Very good at that. Some guys are oblivious, but you ladies are quite aware.
Yeah, we are.
So has he admitted to anything?
Well, he did admit that he had an affair, but he said it was emotional. But he travels a lot. And he was in Las Vegas he's a salesman, and he invited her over. So I did my homework. I went and researched everything. I know that he spent money with her at Las Vegas. He said he didn't sleep with her. And at the therapist, after he admitted it, the therapist said, well, why didn't you? He goes, because I knew that would be the end of my marriage.
Well, I don't know what your husband did with this woman, Teresa, but I will tell you that when I hear someone in marriage counseling say the affair was just emotional, I have about 7 pounds of salt that I take that with. Okay, I generally don't believe it. But I don't know in your husband's situation, I can't say. I would suggest you tell him, I don't want a divorce.
I told him that.
And I'm not going to pursue it. So if you want it, you're going to have to pursue it. You're going to have to be the one that's going to make all the moves, because I'm not going to cooperate in any of this.
Okay.
And you're not threatening him at all. You're just simply saying, this is where I am. Our daughter doesn't deserve this. You don't have to want to be with me, but I will tell you, and I don't know if this is the case with her, but I hear it a lot, when you get these teenagers who look at a parent who breaks up the family, the teenagers oftentimes want to have nothing to do with that parent.
I know it. I know it. And you know what's weird, Dr. Ray? We were watching, we have pictures on our TV that he uploads. See, he thought he deleted them. So me and my daughter were looking at pictures, and they popped up, and she saw it.
What does she think if her dad? If her dad leaves, is she going to say, "Okay, well, I'll just want to live with dad half the time, and I'll live with you half the time"? I didn't think she'd think that. And I think he needs to know that, because I think much of the time when people are thinking of walking out on a marriage, they don't anticipate the complications that are coming.
Well, you know what, Dr. Ray? He came from a divorced family. His dad was a cheater. So all that, it's like I always had it in my heart. I go, I hope he's not like his dad. But he just turned out like his dad.
Well, here's what I would say about that, Teresa.
Tell me. Tell me, please.
I don't think it's because he turned out like his dad.
Okay.
If he came from a divorced family, there's a good chance he wasn't raised well. There's a good chance that he didn't get the kind of religious or moral upbringing that would make him be more committed to a marriage. And if that's the case, then that may be what you're seeing repeated, not the fact that he's this genetic carbon copy of his dad.
Okay.
Now, I know what you're thinking. Teresa, in the very early sentences of the call, said that she had had a previous marriage. Now, I didn't pursue whether she had sought an annulment. Why? Well, a couple of things. Typically on this program, when you get folks who listen routinely to Catholic radio, more often than not, if they talk about a first relationship, there is an annulment. And many times I've asked, they say, yes, we have an annulment. Okay, that's the first thing. Now, I assumed, all right, I just assumed. I could be wrong. And if I was wrong, I could have pursued the idea that, well, Teresa, in the church's eyes, if you were married in the church, it's a sacramental marriage, you're still married to your first person, and you're not married to your current husband, in quotes, you're living with him. So, in fact, if he leaves, this may be a civil divorce with all its legalities, but in the church's eyes, you have just stopped living in sin. Now, I think that's why I put this as a look-back call, because I could have gone in that direction, and I confess ignorance. I just did not pursue it from that direction because she was so much concerned about making this relationship work, which, again, I assumed, shouldn't have, that there was an annulment involved. The third thing is, I don't know. I would say, if I'm going to put a percentage on it, 50%. People come into my office and one of the spouses is very much on the edge of divorce. I mean, they're coming into counseling just because the other spouse said, let's go get counseling. Please, let's go get counseling. They come in and they're doing it to assuage. They're doing it to be able to say, I tried counseling, it didn't work. Just for their own reasons. 50% or more of the time, maybe higher than that, there's another relationship going on with the person who wants the divorce, who is right there. As a matter of fact, who said, we're going to get a divorce, I plan to get a divorce. That's when the to-be-divorced spouse says, please, at least try counseling. Let's at least try counseling. And then the person says, okay, but my experience is, in situations like that, that counseling lasts 1, 2, maybe 3 times before the divorcing spouse says, I'm out of here. Counseling was a waste of time because, in fact, they had no motive to stay married. We'll be curious to see what Teresa's first relationship was resolved as. I'm Dr. Ray.
If you have sustained conversation with non-Catholic Christians, one of the things that always comes up is, why do you confess to a priest? Why would you go to a priest when you can go straight to God? I would say, well, look, I went to Jesus, I looked at his word, and it told me to go to a priest. It is interesting. One of the first things you notice right towards the end of the Gospel of John, that Jesus himself determined to forgive and retain sins through human intermediaries. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained. And Jesus commissioned his apostles on earth to speak in his name, to forgive sins or retain sins, not just metaphorically, but metaphysically.
Cresta in the Afternoon with Al Cresta, 4 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Bishop Robert Barron on the priesthood.
You as a parent apply Galatians 5, is watch your kids as they move into the religious space, if you want to put it that way. I, you know, made noises about the priesthood on and off when I was a little kid. My parents were never oppressive about it. They never pressed me in that direction, but they would quietly indicate an openness to that, or like, that's a good thing. I remember I still have it upstairs, a Bible that my parents got me for Christmas in 1969. I'm a little kid. And it's, you know, from Mom and Dad to Bob, Christmas 1969. They knew, they sensed I was kind of interested in religious things. So I would say that, don't be pushy, of course, but don't go the other direction. That's, my generation got too much of that, was, back off. Who am I to tell you what to do? You make up your mind. No, I think gently, quietly, affirming that, yeah, that's a good thing you're thinking about. And you should be open to that.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Thank you for joining me. No time for another look back call. But this reminds me of a call I heard on Catholic radio where one was talking about a person that he knew who left the faith because he couldn't be convinced. He didn't believe that God could love him, that in fact his sins were too great. And typically my experience has been when people think their sins are too great, they're not as great as others that do believe God loves them. But that's an aside. And of course, one answer to that is we're all sinners. That usually doesn't assuage anybody because they look at sinfulness as a gradient. Yeah, well, we're all sinners, but you ain't the sinner I am. And God has his limit on love for sinners. C.S. Lewis answered it with this. God loves us, not because we are lovable, but because he is love. Not because he needs to receive, but because he delights to give. It's part of our fallen human nature that we attribute to God us. I couldn't see how I could love somebody that did what I did, what I've done. It'd be very, very hard for me to love that person, to feel any kind of warmth toward that person, to want to in any way have anything to do with that person in my life. Therefore, I can't see how God would do that. See, we use our measuring stick to gauge God. I couldn't love, so how can he? He doesn't operate by the same rules that we do. He operates by a completely different set of principles. We can't fathom how a being can love no matter what. We couldn't, or we would suspect we couldn't, given, God forbid, certain heavy, heavy things would happen to us at the hands of another person. So we extrapolate to God. He must be more like me. I couldn't love someone who does all this, so he can't love me. That is a complete misunderstanding of God, and until a person gets to that point where he realizes, I may feel this way, but the reality is God is not that way. And once that is accepted, then a person has much less trouble believing that God can love and forgive him. I almost said them. I could see my sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Elgis, being upset because my predicate did not match my nominative. God is not us. He is love. We, in some respects, are not. We have to work at it. He doesn't. Walk with God. He loves you.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRA.com and follow him on Facebook. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.